Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
A cargo plane crash kills four in Kenya, and the UN is forced to cut food aid to Africa. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. A cargo plane has crashed into a building in Kenya's capital, killing four people on board. The plane hit the two-story building housing small shops shortly after taking off early today from Nairobi's main airport. The aircraft burst into flames, leaving a portion of the building smashed and charred. Investigators say it may have hit an electrical pole before crashing. The flight was carrying a load of Similac hot bound for Somalia. The United Nations World Food Program is reducing food aid to nearly 800 refugees in Africa. The agency says the cuts of 40% to 60% will affect refugees in the Central African Republic, South Sudan, Chad, Uganda, Mauritania, Mozambique, Ghana, Liberia, and Burkina Faso. The WFP spokesman Peter Smeerden told VOA in a telephone interview Tuesday there are two main reasons for the cut.
Mostly it's because of funding difficulties. We haven't got the money to keep full rations on for these people.
Smeerden says security concerns and the difficulty of shipping food by road also plays a role. The UN says 2.4 million refugees across Africa depend on its agencies for food. Health ministers from 11 African nations are meeting today in Ghana to discuss how they should respond to the deadliest ever outbreak of Ebola. The World Health Organization is leading the two-day conference in the Ghanaian capital of Accra after announcing that 467 people have now died from Ebola in West Africa this year. Guinea has been the hardest hit, with 303 deaths attributed to Ebola since April. Tensions between Israelis and Palestinians are running high, fueling a possible revenge killing after the funeral of three kidnapped Jewish teens. Robert Berger reports.
Israeli police fired tear gas at hundreds of stone-throwing Palestinians in an Arab suburb of Jerusalem. The clashes erupted after a Palestinian youth from the neighborhood was found dead. Residents say he was kidnapped outside a mosque and killed in revenge for the murder of three Israeli teenagers who were allegedly abducted by Palestinian militants. Police Commissioner Yohanan Danino urged the public not to draw conclusions and to act with restraint. Robert Berger, Jerusalem.
Police in Hong Kong arrested more than 500 protesters from an overnight sit-in early today that followed a massive pro-democracy rally. The protesters were charged with the illegal assembly and obstructing police after vowing to stay in the city's financial district until 8 a.m. Most protesters did not put up a struggle. However, others had to be dragged away. Mabel Au is with Amnesty International, and she calls the mass arrest disturbing. Tell VOA the protesters are not doing anything illegal.
We didn't see any violence or any kind of riots. It's a very peaceful assembly. And then we do not agree with the police that it is an illegal assembly.
Organizers say 510,000 people attended the protest on the 17th anniversary of the former British colony's return to Chinese governance. A load of Syrian chemical weapons has arrived at an Italian port for destruction, fulfilling an international agreement in the midst of Syria's civil war. The Danish freighter, accompanied by a military helicopter, brought the weapons to the port under heavy security. There is a U.S. military ship that waited to transport them to international waters, where about half of the cargo will be destroyed at sea. The rest will be destroyed at plants in the United States and Europe. Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy had been formally placed under investigation after entering police custody for questioning on Tuesday in an investigation into alleged influence peddling. Mr. Sarkozy is under suspicion of trying to use his influence to obstruct an investigation of his 2007 election campaign. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Villagers here tell VOA that the scarcity and price hikes have impacted their holy obligation during Ramadan, when Muslims are supposed to share food with the underprivileged. But Imam Ibrahim Amadu says Muslims here can forgo certain obligations during this hardship. And he says many may skip the requirement to fast during daylight hours if it is affecting their health.
That's VOA's Moki Edwin Kinzeka reporting from a border village in Cameroon. Details coming up.
Also in the news, a small cargo plane has crashed into a building in Kenya's capital, and health ministers from 11 African nations are meeting in Ghana to discuss and respond to the deadliest ever outbreak of Ebola.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Togo, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Nairobi police say four died in the early morning hours today when a small cargo plane crashed into a building in Kenya's capital. The pilot, co-pilot, navigator, and a cargo handler died in the fiery crash. The plane was taking off under foggy conditions from a private airfield near the building. The only occupants of the two-story building of commercial shops were two guards. Both were injured. The plane was bound for Somalia with a load of cotton, a plant whose leaves are a popular mild stimulant in the region. Cot is grown on plantations throughout East Africa and exported to Middle Eastern countries.
Also in East Africa, the Uganda People's Defense Forces, or UPDF, fighting alongside declared terrorists of the Lord's Resistance Army. However, a Seleka spokesman denied cooperating with the LRA. The charge was made today after clashes on Sunday and Monday, in which 15 Seleka and several Ugandan troops died. A Seleka official confirmed the deaths yesterday, but he said the Ugandan forces mistook the Seleka as LRA members. The UPDF spokesman replied today that the Seleka are in bed with LRA fighters. The mostly Muslim Seleka forces formed 2 years ago and ousted the government of the Central African Republic in Bangui. Their brief rule under Michel Djotodia degenerated into a sectarian war with Christian Community Defense Forces called Anti-Balaka. Currently, Uganda is participating in an African Union peacekeeping force targeting units of the LRA and their Ugandan leader, Joseph Kony. Kony has been charged with human rights abuses by an international criminal court in The Hague, Netherlands. While about 100 U.S. special forces are assisting the 5,000 AU troops, the U.S. State Department said none were involved in the weekend clash.
Coming up on 9 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. A delegation from the Uganda Electoral Commission has completed a week-long visit to Malawi to study voter education processes. But as Lamek Messina reports from Blantyre, some analysts question whether Uganda can learn anything from Malawi's recent flawed elections.
Uganda has less than 2 years to prepare for the national elections, and this time, election officials say they want to do a better job. Speaking to reporters on Wednesday in Blantyre, the director of operations at the Uganda Electoral Commission, Leonard Mulekwa, explained why his three-person delegation came to Malawi.
We did our last election in 2011, and we did post-election review. And the population and the political parties told us we did not do enough voter education. We're following the Malawi elections, and what we're seeing, we're big turn-up of people at rallies, big turn-up of people at registration centers. So we thought maybe there's something Malawi is doing to mobilize these people, which we may not be doing.
Malawian officials brought their Ugandan counterparts to civil society groups, which were instrumental in getting information to the electorate. Mulekwa says they can learn a lot from groups like Malawi's National Initiative for Civic Education, which distributed information about voting in public places.
For example, if you look at things like procession walks, going to health units when mothers are transnatal, their immunization, going to marketplaces, you know, writing letters to parents, writing letters to all categories of leaders. These were very new initiatives to us, and we think we have picked a lot of lessons from here, which, when we go back, of course, we are going to urge the Commission to adopt.
However, some analysts are raising eyebrows at the idea any country could learn from Malawi after the elections in May were marred by the widespread irregularities. Jessica Bwira, spokesperson for the opposition Malawi Congress Party, said she thinks the Ugandan delegation was not given the true picture of how Malawi conducted its voter registration.
For example, civic and voter education was problematic from an ethnic perspective. There was regionalism in the way NEC did it. When they came to the central region, it was all done at one time. Yet in the other places, specifically in the south, voter education was done first and then the voting happened later. But with the central region, there was very weird things happening. Some of the places did not even get voter education.
The Malawi Electoral Commission says there weren't enough official complaints at any stage of the electoral process. Ernest Tindwa is a political science lecturer at the Chancellor College of the University of Malawi. He says Uganda should look at not only what Malawi did well to prepare for the elections, but what it didn't do well. Shortages of ballot papers and ink sparked anger among voters in some polling centers in Blantyre.
One of the challenges Malawians had was not having necessary materials in polling centers at the right time. So that's an area where Uganda needs to learn that there can be some areas where, if not properly executed, can lead to problems. So overall, there are both positive and negative things Uganda can learn and be attentive to areas where Malawi might have failed.
Opposition groups in Uganda have long complained of irregularities in the country's elections. Long-time President Yoweri Museveni has won the last three elections amid allegations of bribery, intimidation, and violence. Attempts by the opposition to challenge the elections in court have been futile. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Muslims in Cameroon are observing Ramadan in the face of serious price hikes for food due to border closures to protect against incursions from the Nigerian militant group Boko Haram. Nigeria supplies up to 80% of food in North Cameroon. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports.
Here at Amchide, the normal bustling trade with Nigerian businesses is at a standstill. Local Imam Ibrahim Amadu says Cameroon soldiers closed the border just ahead of Ramadan as a security measure against Nigeria's Boko Haram militants who have been plaguing this part of Cameroon in recent months with theft, kidnappings, gun running and attacks. He says the problem for his village is Nigeria is the main source of food and traders are nervous.
80% of our rice is imported. It's very risky for a businessman to carry rice knowing that there's going to be a problem. Even maize, you also have oil, we have sugar. In fact, all the food that the Muslims need during the month of the Ramadan, there's a problem. Because of this barbaric act of Boko Haram, most of the businessmen will not want to come in.
At the Amchide Motor Park, shoe vendor Haliru Kakoi tells VOA that some foodstuffs are no longer available and others, like sugar, now sell for 50% higher.
Jottabe digabe mabbe frontiere gal Nigeria do warti kujeji man fu chadi ko pade soso be
kujeji. He says everything is becoming expensive and some prices have doubled. Consequently, no one wants to buy and business is at a standstill in their market. 9 out of 10 people in Amchide make their money through trade, and so the border closure and ensuing inflation has hit household incomes hard. Sumu Bakari says he used to make about $200 a day but now he barely eggs out $50.
Quand le marché est bon, je peux même souvent laisser même 5,000. Et quand c'est mauvais, tu peux même laisser même 1,000 francs.
He says he's had to cut food money during Ramadan from $10 to $2, and his family is struggling. Villagers here tell VOA that the scarcity and price hikes have impacted their holy obligation during Ramadan, when Muslims are supposed to share food with the underprivileged. But Imam Ibrahim Amadu says Muslims here can forgo certain obligations during this hardship. And he says many may skip the requirement to fast during daylight hours if it is affecting their health.
According to the Islamic law, they can drop the fasting if the prices are too high in such a way that they cannot be able to afford those basic needs during the month of the Ramadan. After that, when the prices drop, they can then fast.
Cameroon's Minister of Trade, Luc Magouan-Balgatangana, tells VOA the government plans to assist the North during Ramadan.
Le gouvernement est vigilant et nous n'accepterons pas de débordement sur les prix.
He says the government is concerned about the impact of price increases and is discussing ways to make available basic commodities such as maize, rice, fish, palm oil and flour. Strict border security measures are expected to impact trade long after Ramadan and hit Nigerian business as well. Nigeria buys quite a large quantity of cotton, sorghum, or grain crop for animal feed, maize, rice, and onions from North Cameroon, and there are huge piles of stock sitting or rotting. Both governments are actively fighting Boko Haram, but militants appear to be intensifying their 5-year-old insurgency and remain a threat for the foreseeable future. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Amchide.
Health ministers from 11 African nations are meeting today in Ghana to discuss how they should respond to the deadliest ever outbreak of Ebola. The World Health Organization is leading the 2-day conference in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, after announcing that 467 people have now died from Ebola in West Africa this year. Guinea has been the hardest hit, with 303 deaths attributed to Ebola since April. The overall numbers are lower in Sierra Leone and Liberia, but both countries have reported a sharp increase in cases and deaths from the highly contagious disease in the past month. The other countries taking part in the conference include Ivory Coast, Gambia, Guinea-Bissau, Mali, Senegal, Uganda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. The WHO is calling for a strong response to contain the outbreak, particularly in the area where Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia share a border.
Past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A new drug to fight the drug-resistant form of tuberculosis, DRTB, has been approved by South Africa's Medicines Controls Council, the MCC. The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders is celebrating what it calls a victory for the generic use of linezolid, a high-strength antibiotic used to treat patients with DRTB. The aid organization, also known by its French acronym MSF, had been using the expensive drug in individualized drug regimens to treat patients with the disease. However, with the MCC approval of the generic drug, MSF will be allowed to treat more patients at a significant cost savings. Julia Hill is MSF's advocacy officer for South Africa. She spoke with me about the significance of the approval of the new drug.
MSF has been trying to get access to a more affordable version of this product for the past 3 years, and we were finally able to do so by applying with the Medicines Control Council of South Africa, which is the regulatory authority, for special permission to import a generic into South Africa. So this application was based on the unaffordability of the product that was available in South Africa, and It's quite a significant first step, actually, because it means that other healthcare providers within South Africa, including the National Department of Health, could actually do the same thing to try and get access to this generic product and expand access to other tuberculosis patients in South Africa. It really could open up access to hundreds of patients who could benefit, if not thousands of patients across the country. The other kind of exciting thing is that it could mean that we would actually have a product fully registered in South Africa in the near future, which would do the same thing actually without having to get this special permission. It would allow the product to be used in South Africa to treat drug-resistant TB patients.
How is this particular drug being used right now?
Right now, MSF is one of a small number of healthcare providers in South Africa who's providing it to patients who have extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis, which means that they're resistant to most of the drugs that are used to treat TB. And really, right now, the treatment options that we have for drug-resistant TB, they aren't very good. So patients need to take thousands of pills over 2 years. They have to deal with painful injections and really terrible side effects. And less than half the patients that actually start the treatment are cured. So we really need shorter and more efficacious regimens. And we finally have some new TB drugs coming to market, as well as drugs like linezolid, which show quite a bit of promise in treating TB, even though that's not what they were originally designed for. So linezolid really could play a very key role in designing a better treatment regimen. But right now, it is within the World Health Organization guidelines and the national guidelines in South Africa for patients with extensively drug-resistant TB. And we just really need to make sure that these key drugs are actually available at affordable prices if we want to be able to scale up access to them.
Will the generic form of linezolid be available only in South Africa?
It's sold in a number of countries, the original product. In South Africa, what this means is that actually MSF is the only actor within South Africa that will have access to this generic at a price that's about 88% lower than the 700 rand price tag that we're currently purchasing it at in the private sector. I guess it points to the need to actually have affordable medicines available in many other countries, because South Africa isn't the only country where there's a monopoly supplier that is selling at an exorbitantly high price. So we think that it's a very big step forward in terms of promoting access to affordable medicines. We're hopeful that other countries can also find solutions where there are barriers to accessing affordable versions of linezolid.
Do you all have any concerns in using the generic form of linezolid?
No, so the product that MSF is using is registered by the UK regulatory authority. It's also approved by the Global Fund for purchase in Global Fund eligible countries in treating TB. And MSF also follows national guidelines and has additional protocols in place to monitor how linezolid is used. But this product is equivalent to the original product and will be used in accordance with national guidelines.
That was Julia Hill, MSF's advocacy officer for South Africa. She spoke with me from Johannesburg.
The Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, ISIS, has declared that its chief, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, is the leader of a new caliphate, a historical term to denote a sovereign state for the Muslim faithful. The term was last widely recognized to describe the government of the Ottoman Empire. ISIS was once al-Qaeda's affiliate in Iraq, but the terror group's leaders disowned the group early this year for its desire to carve out a caliphate and refusing to obey orders. Paul Selin is the Vice President for Policy and Research at the Middle East Institute. VOA's Susan Yaki asked for his reaction to a new caliphate being declared in Iraq and Syria.
It adds a new level, a new dimension to the dramatic events that have been taking place over the last few weeks. I think it indicates that ISIS or ISIL is thinking of a long-term presence in a large geographic space, a big part of Iraq and Syria. I had written previously that I think this is a development which will be with us for a long time, because the Shiite-led governments both in Baghdad and Damascus have failed to bring in the Sunnis. And this sort of breakaway by Sunni communities at this point, using ISIS or accepting ISIS as a spearhead reflect a larger political, you know, malaise or, you know, division in the region. I don't think ISIS's dominance in this region will be uncontested or necessarily very long term. I think the fact that they went ahead and declared a state, as it were, might in fact bring them even more rapidly into conflict with other groups in these contested zones. At the same time, I think this declaration does reverberate around the Islamic world among radicals and jihadis, that this is sort of putting forward a sort of the skeleton of a new project, which is to bring back the caliphate. This has been part of Islamist radical discourse for a whole century, since the caliphate was abolished by the Turks in 1924. So this will resonate and might have sort of reverberations in other countries and communities who might look favorably at this development. So I think it's significant. It complicates the situation even more than it was. But it will not, be uncontested. It won't be as if they're just going to go ahead and set up an Islamic State and a caliph, and that's just going to be accepted as part of the normality. But it does throw a new concept into the mix.
How should the international community react to this, or should they react at all?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's much to react in terms of the, you know, the declaration or not. This is a group that, you know, Al-Qaeda declares things, this group declares things. It's not as if there is now a caliphate that one has to, you know, take positions for or against. So I wouldn't necessarily think that the international community per se needs to react to the declaration. I think that is more something of concern to the Muslim world, Islamic countries, for whom, you know, this is part of their history and positions as Islamic societies or states. They will definitely take positions about, largely, I mean, would imagine nobody will accept it. I don't think the West needs to, you know, react to it per se. The West needs to, and the international community needs to react to, you know, what's going on, broadly in Syria and Iraq, the disintegration effectively of that entire part of the Middle East. Obviously, great loss of life, great instability, a great risk to security, not only in the region, but also Western security, since there are hundreds of Western fighters fighting in Syria and Iraq with these jihadi groups, and some of them are already coming home and do pose a risk. The West really has not had a policy, or at least an effective policy, to deal with this double crisis of Syria and Iraq, and they really sort of have merged into one terrible, perfect storm. That needs addressing. But the caliphate, if somebody announces a caliphate, I don't think necessarily the international community needs to take a position on it.
Paul Saleen, Vice President for Policy and Research at the Middle East Institute. He was speaking to VOA's Susan Yaki. This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can't these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Put your flags up in the sky. Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit voafootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at voafootball.com.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. A small cargo plane has crashed into a building in Kenya's capital. Health ministers from 11 African nations are meeting today in Ghana to discuss how they should respond to the deadliest ever outbreak of Ebola. And Muslims in Cameroon observe Ramadan in the face of serious price hikes for food. Coming up, we have music from Togo, and in our feature segment, a U.S. scholarship to 28 economically disadvantaged but academically gifted Zimbabwean students. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next.
Put your flags up in the sky.
That means it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday, Kim.
Thank you, Sunny. I understand we've reached the last eight teams at the World Cup.
Kim, the field for the quarterfinals is now set at the Football World Cup in Brazil. France versus Germany will kick things off Friday with an all-European match in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Then we'll head to the northeast coastal city of Fortaleza, where Brazil will host Colombia Friday in an all-South American encounter. The Colombians feature James Rodriguez, who's being described as the breakout star at Brazil 2014. The Monaco midfielder has 5 goals in the tournament, making him the World Cup's top scorer. On Saturday, there will be 2 more quarterfinals. Belgium will battle Argentina in the Brazilian capital, Brasilia, and that will be followed by a game between the Netherlands and Costa Rica in Salvador, Brazil. Now, before this World Cup kicked off, Los Ticos from Costa Rica were rated one of the biggest long shots to win the trophy. But in the group stage, they topped a group that included former World Cup champions Uruguay, Italy, and England. And then they beat Greece 5-3 on penalty kicks in the round of 16. This marks the best ever World Cup showing for Los Ticos from Costa Rica. In World Cup results Tuesday, Argentina and Belgium both won in extra time. Superstar Lionel Messi set up Angel Di Maria in the 118th minute as Argentina topped Switzerland 1-0 in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And Belgium beat the USA 2-1 in Salvador, Brazil. The Red Devils of Belgium were technically superior in attack throughout the match. They finally broke through in the 93rd minute on a goal by Kevin De Bruyne. Teammate Romelu Lukaku, whose father, Roger, once played for the former Zaire's national football team, was a powerful presence once he entered the match in extra time for the Belgians. Lukaku scored in the 105th minute before the Americans pulled one back in the 107th minute on a wonderful volley by 19-year-old Julius Green. And let's give a Sunny Side of Sports shout-out for Julius, the youngest American player to appear in a World Cup match. He was making his World Cup debut against the Belgians, and what a debut it was as he scored on his first touch. For reaction to the USA's 2-1 loss to Belgium, we're joined by VOA's Tadi Abeje, and Tadi begins with the USA's German coach.
U.S. head coach Jurgen Klinsmann was disappointed by his team's elimination, but he expressed pride in how they performed in the World Cup competitions.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's a bummer. We were so close. I mean, that I think we can all be very, very proud of this team. What they've done the last couple of weeks has been unbelievable, outstanding. When we pushed Belgium to the limits, or even beyond, you know, they could have gone either way, you know, and this is how these knockout games are. Then at the end, you know, you need a little bit of luck. And that it's going your way, and today we didn't have that. But I think that, you know, if you look at those four games that we played here in Brazil, I mean, they've done a tremendous job.
USA goalkeeper Tim Howard had 16 saves, the most since the stat was introduced in the World Cup in 1966. Howard shared Klinsmann's sentiments and was not apologetic about how his team played yesterday in Salvador, Brazil.
You know, it's heartbreaking. We gave everything. I don't think we could have given any more. What a great game of football. God, we left it all out there. We got beat by a really good team. You know, they took their chance as well, and it's heartache. It hurts.
For the tens of thousands of American fans that traveled to Brazil, and for millions more in the U.S. watching the game on TV, the loss was painful.
Great, great, hard effort for the team. It just didn't work out in our favor today, honestly.
My heart is broken. My heart is done. I'm boycotting Belgian waffles, chocolate, Stella Artois. Everything Belgian is boycotted.
I mean, it's a rough one. I mean, we made it this far is all I can say. We made it out of the group of death, and that's what you can expect right now. So.
4 years ago, if you told me that we were going to lose to Germany by one and take Belgium to overtime, would have been great. So now America's got a bright future. Definitely. Yeah. Bright future.
For the Sunny Side of Sports, I'm VOA's Tadi Abeje.
Voice of America.
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit VOAfootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at VOAfootball.com. I mentioned Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is at VOA Sunny Sports. Joining us once again is our football guru, David Legg. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
Argentina, led by the magical Messi, through to the quarterfinals once again. They're bidding for a third world title. Argentina 1, Switzerland 0 in extra time, David, in Sao Paulo, with Messi once again playing a huge role. Your thoughts?
Yes, Sonny, so near and yet so far for the gallant Swiss. They held them for 118 minutes. And then Di Maria, who in the second period of extra time had looked increasingly dangerous and was being given a lot of space out on the right flank, Messi created it, and Di Maria put it away. In terms of possession, in terms of chances, Argentina were the dominant force and certainly deserved their victory. But one's heart went out for the Swiss. They defended with great discipline, were just 2 minutes away from a shootout. And even after they went behind from a free kick, they headed the ball against the post. And when it came out, it struck the same Swiss player and dribbled just wide. So a really dramatic end to a match that at times really didn't take off. It wasn't certainly one of the classics that we've seen in Brazil at the World Cup. But Argentina now through to the last eight, and I guess in the eyes of many people, one step closer to what I suppose in South America would be the dream final, Brazil against Argentina.
David, Africa's two best hopes to reach the quarterfinals, Algeria and Nigeria, both eliminated by European opponents. Nigeria fell to France 2-0 in the Brazilian capital, Brasilia, while the Desert Foxes of Algeria lost to Germany 2-1 in extra time in Porto Alegre, Brazil. Let's begin with the France-Nigeria match, David, and your thoughts.
Well, Sonny, there's no doubt about it. Nigeria did have their chances, and the disallowed goal by Emmanuel Emenike midway through the first half was a hairline decision. I think when you look at the replay and they freeze it just as the ball is passed through to Emenike, if you look around Emenike himself, the defenders definitely appear to be putting him offside. But if you look at the very top of the frame, I believe a French defender actually had him onside. But it was a really close decision and could have made a world of difference in the end. Nigeria had their chances, Sonny, early in the second half especially. And working here at Agence France-Presse in Johannesburg, I remember commenting to a French colleague of mine who was growing increasingly worried about the French team. I said, the Nigerians have had their chances. They haven't taken them. Look out, France are going to win. And that's exactly what happened. And how ironic that Vincent Enyema, who really embellished his reputation in these finals, one of the outstanding goalkeepers at the World Cup, he flapped at a corner and the ball hit the head of Paul Pogba and landed in the net after 79 minutes. And the body language to me, Sonny, said the Nigerians were not going to equalize. And unfortunately, 2 minutes into stoppage time, Joseph Yoba conceded an own goal. And to me, a rather flattering 2-0 victory for France. I think a 1-0 scoreline would have been a fairer reflection. But well done, Nigeria. They got to the last 16 for a record third time for an African side. And if their finishing had just been that little bit sharper, they could have made it through to the next round. To me, Sonny, a vital difference between the Europeans and the African sides in this World Cup, it's the finishing. The Europeans and the South Americans, they're just that much sharper than the African sides.
Stephen Keshi, the first African coach to lead a team into the World Cup's round of 16. He appears to be on his way out as Nigeria's coach now, David.
Yes, Sonny, he's resigned. Not a major surprise. He's had his fair share of problems, one of them being the fact that we've reported many times on Voice of America.
Voice of America!
That he simply wasn't getting paid. One stage he went 6 months without any salary, and that's not really on for a professional. I think Keshi will look back with pride at his reign in Nigeria. He led them unexpectedly to the 2013 Africa Cup of Nations title. And while many Nigerians will undoubtedly be disappointed at a last 16 exit, the fact is he did become the first African coach to lead a side into the second round at a World Cup. And for that, we must congratulate him. Now, the rumour mill is quite strong that he could take over the South African side. Gordon Igerson's contract has not been renewed. And the initial favourite was Carlos Queiroz from Portugal, who led Iran at the World Cup, with Keshi sort of second favourite. But it looks now as if South Africa may, in fact, hire both men, Queiroz as technical director and Keshi as coach of the national team.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. And we'll hear more soccer-licious commentary from David during the month-long Football World Cup in Brazil. Remember, VOA World Cup fans, the final at the Football Jamboree will be played July 13th in Rio de Janeiro. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahéus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
In our feature segment, the third part of a series on specialty beer in South Africa. And next, a U.S. scholarship to 28 economically disadvantaged but academically gifted Zimbabwean students. But first, some music. Here is Hosti of Togo with Miasimi.
Yeah. devi manyo me baba ma bechire nya po na manya mundo pleza plenu gede gede wo kata no binyewe
and put it up and give each other a hug, cause I don't know why we hate others. We all one blood, but different color, living in one world, sharing different nature, the same people using different culture. As a god children, we need to love each other, stop the blood sharing, cause little ones are dying.
Hosty of Togo with Miasime.
Well, South Africa's craft beer sector is expanding rapidly. Previously, the only beer available was mass-produced in factories. Now, independent brewers are making specialty brews. The beer is handcrafted using pure ingredients, including hops, barley, malt, and water. The flavors of craft beer vary greatly from fruit to honey to coffee and many more. Beers can run from extremely bitter to pleasantly sweet. Commercial mass-produced beer is often made using chemicals and preservatives. It's generally much less flavorful than craft beer. In the third part of our series on specialty beer in South Africa, Darren Taylor reports on some of the brewers behind the boom.
Sounds of nature dominate at Dirk van Tonderen's alehouse on his farm in Northwest Province. Some Belgian tourists sit at a rough wooden table. Their faces grow red under the hot sun and from pints of the brewer's wheat beer. Van Tonderen refuses to bottle his beer to turn a big profit by selling it in fancy bars and restaurants in the cities. No wonder a recent book on the rise of craft beer in South Africa calls him a maverick.
Well, I think describing me as a maverick is very generous of them. They could have maybe described me as a pauper, a very creative pauper. Basically, I think that's what I am. I'm certainly not driven by financial issues. My greatest wealth and assets does not lie in money. It lies in my friends and my followers. And that's how I see it.
Van Tonderen began making beer after tasting artisanal brew at a food festival near Johannesburg in the late 1980s.
I was in awe. I couldn't get enough of this, and I had maybe a sip or two of the product there, and I thought, you make your own beer? Wow, this is too good to be true.
Another brewer, Moritz Kalmeier, learned to make beer when he was a boy on a farm near Pretoria. A labourer taught him to brew by adding sugar to sorghum and fermenting it. When his mother noticed his interest, she bought him a book by a woman called Anna Olivier with instructions on how to make your own wine.
I started making my own wines from apples and anything that the greengrocer would give me for free, I would use Anna's book and made wine quite successfully at a young age.
Kalmeier started brewing beer while pursuing a career using exercise to rehabilitate injured athletes. He had his own gym. He'd test his beers on his clients. In 1997, he opened Drayman's Brewery. South Africa's sudden thirst for specialty beer means Kalmeier's finally making some money. Applause and cheering greet Steve Gilroy's entrance onto the stage in a hall inside his brewery on the outskirts of Johannesburg. Gilroy is famous, or rather infamous, for his beer speeches. He tells people about his beer and how it's made, but often he seems more of a stand-up comedian than a beer brewer.
Fermented fruit juice. That's what wine is. Oh no, it's also vinegar that hasn't gone off properly yet. Beer is the work of the Lord. I'm just his best little helper.
Gilroy moved to South Africa from Britain more than 40 years ago. He says it wasn't the culture or the heat of the country that shocked him. It was the horrible beer, as he puts it.
When I came to South Africa, I couldn't drink the beer. I was used to the bigger beers. and they simply didn't have it. It was just a sea of generic lagers. So I started home brewing.
For many years, he owned a printing company. Gilroy says the computerization of printing finally forced him to do what he's always wanted to.
And I thought, at my age, do I really want to get involved in all the new technology when anybody with a computer is a printer? Or do I follow my passion? And my passion's always been beer. So we started off the little microbrewery.
Deep in the Magaliesberg Mountains, north of Johannesburg, is an estate that once bred Frisian horses. It's also home to the luxurious Black Horse Brewery.
So basically how it all started was, one night my dad got really drunk, and he promised a whole lot of friends that he would like to start a brewery. And he realized that it's too expensive to just be a hobby, so we'll have to change it into a business.
At 21 years of age, Nushka Buerta is the youngest brewer and one of only two female commercial specialty beer brewers in South Africa. The other brewers here are almost exclusively middle-aged or elderly men. Buerta acknowledges she still struggles to fit into the circle.
In the beginning, it was a bit intimidating, basically, but you get used to it after a while, and not everybody likes me a lot, but it's okay. I don't mind. That actually just tells me that I'm really good at my job. So
people do indeed seem to love Buerta's beer. She sighs that the 2,000 litres she currently makes every month doesn't begin to satisfy the demand for it.
Our sources are there, and the people want our beer, and our new brewery is on its way. It's being shipped out of China as we speak. Then we'll be going up to about 18,000 litres a month.
All the brewers driving South Africa's artisanal beer boom are mirrored in the beers they produce, unique, each with idiosyncrasies. They're often divided in their approaches to their craft, but ultimately united in their attempts to make good beer. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
The United States has provided $6 million worth of scholarships to 28 economically disadvantaged but academically gifted Zimbabwean students under the United States Archivers Program. Irwin Chifera has details from Harare.
At a send-off ceremony for the 28 who are going to study at some of the top universities in America, U.S. Ambassador to Zimbabwe Bruce Wharton said the USA program has seen talented Zimbabweans excelling at some of the best universities in the world, adding the recipients will no doubt help develop their country upon return.
The long-term purpose of USAP is to build Zimbabwe and the positive connections between the United States and Zimbabwe. Now, I hope that you will all commit to that ideal and use your time in the U.S. to gain skills and develop plans that you can put to work back in Zimbabwe in the future.
All the students were grateful for making it under the USAP program, adding, without the U.S. Embassy Education Section's assistance, they would not have realized their dream of studying at some of the top universities in the world. Charity Bebe from Matabeleland North, who is headed for Arizona State University, where she will study public health and women empowerment, tells Studio 7 she will come back to assist the disadvantaged women in her community.
Education for women, and most women, they're like the people who are vulnerable. So they need us. They need us to empower them and speak up for those women. So that's why I wanted to join Empowerment and Development. And then I promise I'm coming back to Zimbabwe for you. To the women out there, I'm coming back, and this country is going to change for the better, definitely.
Bezum Pasiri, who was raised by a single parent, is excited. He says without USAP, university education would have been a pipe dream.
It's pretty exciting considering my financial situation. My dad passed away when I was in grade 3. So it was kind of hard for my mom to raise me, paying the boarding fees and stuff. So it's quite an achievement. I'm so excited. After I complete my studies, I plan on gaining experience, then come back to Zimbabwe to rebuild my country just because I want to study economics and computer science with specializations in software engineering. So I want to upgrade the software industry of Zimbabwe.
Tatenda Nyandoro, who had commenced economic studies at the University of Zimbabwe, there. Since his program of choice is not offered locally, says USAP has enabled him to pursue his dream.
I'm so happy about it because my dream is now coming true. Since I'm now able to go for my program, which I really wanted, which is not offered here in Zimbabwe, I want to study performing arts.
Today's ceremony was attended by former USAP graduates. Some of them have completed their studies and are working in Zimbabwe. Parents, relatives, and friends of the 2014 USAP class also attended the event. Since the launch of the program 14 years ago, more than 1,200 Zimbabweans have completed their studies or are enrolled at American universities. An initiative of the U.S. Embassy in Harare, USAP has been replicated in 12 countries on four continents. From Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopez, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
In its continuing effort to assist other nations in confronting terrorism and to protect American citizens and interests, the United States is offering significant rewards to locate four terrorists operating in Western and Northern Africa. Hamad al-Khairi and Ahmad el-Talemsi are founding members of the Movement for Unity and Jihad in West Africa, or MUJWA, and former members of the terrorist group Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. Khalid al-Barnawi reportedly leads the Nigeria-based terrorist group Ansaru, and Abu Yusuf al-Muhajir is an explosives expert involved in planning attacks against a variety of targets in Egypt. All four have planned or taken part in violent attacks on Western interests or abductions of foreign nationals. Al-Barnawi, a Nigerian citizen born in 1976, and Ansaru have committed multiple acts of terrorism and kidnappings in his native land. He is also known as Mohammed Usman, Khalid al-Barnawi, and Abu Hafsat, among other aliases. Al-Khairi, a citizen of Mali, was born in Mauritania in 1970. He has claimed responsibility for the April 2012 kidnapping of seven Algerian diplomats in Mali. He has also appeared in videos making threats against those who oppose his group, which was named a specially designated global terrorist entity by the U.S. Department of State 2 years ago. Al-Khairi is also known as Abu Kamkam and Amada Ould Khairu, among other aliases. Born in 1977, Ahmed el-Talemsi is also Malian and a founding member of the MUJWA. Among its violent activities, in March 2012, the group mounted a suicide attack in Taman Rasset, Algeria, which wounded 23 people. He is also known as Abdurrahmani Ould El-Amar and Abdurrahmani Tujaji. Abu Yusuf al-Muhajir was born September 7, 1986, in Egypt. He has been active in terrorist operations in the Sinai Peninsula, ascribing to a global jihadist ideology and targeting civilians and governments he believes do not abide by Islamic law. He is also known as Hamza al-Maskin, among other aliases. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million each for leading to the location of al-Barnawi, al-Khairi, and al-Talemsi, and up to $3 million for information leading to the arrest or conviction of al-Muhajir. The United States guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the United States is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on any of these individuals, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate or submit a tip at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. You can also call the RFJ tip line at 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Africa Health Network, a multimedia network reaching 50 million Africans weekly. We bring you relevant, reliable health news and information. We ask you about the health problems most important to you and inform you about health problems impacting your community. VOA Africa Health Network. Visit our website at www.africahealthnetwork.com.